Okay, good afternoon. My name is Jason Bauman. I'm coordinator of LGBT collections for the New York Public Library, and I'm really thrilled that you are here and you are here. This is our last program. We've had an exhibition on 1969, the year of gay liberation, that's been up in the Stokes Gallery for the month of June, and tomorrow is the last day. And we've also had a whole menu of programs here at the library to be in conjunction with the exhibition. I'm just going to say a few words. One of the reasons we're having this exhibition, aside from the importance, the historical importance of the events that are chronicled in the exhibition and the many and the programs that we're having, is New York Public Library has one of the greatest collections of LGBT activist history in the country. Archives that go from Manachin Society of New York to ACT UP New York. Really a whole generation of gay and lesbian activists whose history is chronicled in the New York Public Library's collections. So really my job is to try and connect the public at large with these collections and make them available to a wider audience and let people know about really the riches that are here at the library. A few times people have asked me sort of to quantify how much material this is. I had this horrible weekend where I sort of added up the linear feet of every collection that's really LGBT historical material, and it came to like 1.7 miles. And that, so that material is Manachin Society of New York, Gay Activists Alliance, activists like Barbara Giddings and Kate Tobin LaHousse and Craig Rodwell's papers, ACT UP New York's papers, GMHC, but then also major artists and writers such as Auden, Virginia Woolf, William Burroughs, Charles Ludlam. We just got the archives of the Martin Warman archive of Caquette's material. So it's really this really broad archival holdings that really cover LGBT history and culture from a very, very wide perspective. So that's why we're doing the exhibition, which I hope you have all seen, and if you haven't, that you'll take a little peek upstairs, because this is the last chance to see it. And I'm looking forward to this discussion today. So I'll pass it on to Christopher.
Wonderful. And the poster for the exhibition is quite beautiful. I hope you all saw it as you came in on Fifth Avenue. The text is great, and the color is quite stunning, the nice chartreuse. So the New York Public Library is pleased to be offering teen programming in relation to the exhibition currently taking place at the Stephen A. Schwarzman Building, celebrating the 40th year of the Stonewall Riots. My name is Chris Shoemaker, and I'm the Young Adult Programming Specialist for the library, and we worked with several people to help pull together a panel to deal with voices in activism. So I hope you are all here for Speak Out, Act Up. As gay marriage and equal rights issues are under discussion in the media and in many communities, we're hoping this panel can help spotlight how to get your voice out there and how to get involved with the discussion. Our guests today are Martin Boyce and Philip Bachman. David Carter was our original moderator, and he was going to be bringing Tommy Lanigan Schmidt along with him. However, they are both in Washington, D.C. today, being recognized by the president for their work at the Stonewall Riots. So congratulations to them, and we're going to have an excellent panel despite their absence. So our first panelist is Philip Bachman. He's seated to my far left. Philip is an author, activist, and psychotherapist working in New York City. He has written about his participation in the Stonewall Riots and other early experiences in Stonewall, the revolution that sparked the gay, the riots that sparked the gay revolution, and Boys Like Us, Gay Writers Tell Their Coming Out Stories. In the 1980s, he regularly wrote for the Christopher Street magazine and contributed to the New York Native newspaper, both landmark gay publications. He helped found the first GLAAD phone tree and wrote hundreds of protest letters for their media committee. In his psychotherapy practice, he has worked to help people deal with the prejudices and discrimination of being gay and find their voices in the important struggle for equal rights. He lives with his partner, Paul Feeler, who is also a psychotherapist in the community. Our other panelist is Martin Boyce. Martin is a native New Yorker, and on the night of the 1969 Stonewall Riot, Martin Boyce was out as Miss Boyce and joined arms with other protesters to sing the famous lines, "We are the village girls, we wear our hair in curls, we wear our dungarees above our Nelly knees." As a child, Martin was an avid library user, often checking out books from the Central Children's Collection located in this building. He's pleased to be returning to his childhood library, and we welcome both of our guests to the stage right now.
Thank you.
Thank you.
So let's go ahead, and if you could just open the discussion by talking about your stories, how you, what you were doing back in 1969, how you got involved with the gay rights movement, and how that's contributed to where you are today.
Okay, so I'm the only militant left. The others are in Washington. But a scare drag, I wasn't a full drag queen. I don't know if everybody knows what scare drag is. But scare drag is like Boy George, when you recognize someone's very feminine, but you can still tell they're a boy. And it had safety aspects, because if you like truckers and things, they know who you are before they take you in. There's no surprises, and less murder happens. The night of Stonewall was like any night. Thomas Lanigan Schmitt tried to get into Stonewall a little earlier that night. He wasn't able to. So me and Birdie and Tommy were deciding what we were going to do. In the meantime, there was enormous commotion down the block. We were further to the east. And what happened was a number of people were passing us saying there was a raid. Curiously, we went over there to see what happened. And this is normally what you did during a raid. You wanted to see who was arrested. You wanted to make sure that you had, you were glad you were not one of them. A certain sense of schadenfreude, certain people you didn't like was getting arrested, how wonderful. You know, things like that. It was, we were just regular young queens. But this was very different. It turned out to be very different. And no one had a plan. When I got to in front of the bar, there was a paddy wagon. And a police officer was up on the paddy wagon, and a high heel came out and hit him and nearly sent him backwards. He did get that queen under control and closed the door, and they left. In the meantime, we all were making an amphitheater, an arc around the Stonewall door. And the police decided that, well, with very nonchalantly, they were going to disperse us. It wasn't going to be a problem. But something changed. We had started moving forward, everybody in a group. And the police began to move forward and then realized it was different and started moving backward. We had seen these faces arresting us. We had seen these faces in their contempt of us, their harassment for years. And they blinked. They started really to move back towards into the bar. This was not an anti-straight riot. It was an anti-police riot. They were the enemy. They were the symbol. And they were the instrument of a lot of our sorrows. But seeing them that night, it's amazing how what hatred can do. It was as if we were at Dachau, and there was nothing between us and our former guards. And we kept moving. They were forced into the bar. They closed the huge, strong doors with the speakeasy window. They looked out. One of the scared drag queens, Miss, and she's in the famous photo, Miss New Orleans, almost single-handedly, as skinny as she was, grabbed a meter. Others helped her and started smashing the door. The police were laughing at first, but there was a growing sense of alarm in their eyes. Some queen, I don't know how she had it, had some lighting fluid and set the doors on fire. And fire started. And you could see they were on the phone, and now they were calling for help. Help did arrive, but it didn't do them much good. Because a riot, as I don't know if you know, is not it's not a stationary thing, it's a kinetic thing. We were moving around constantly in different spots. But we were used to this because we had a situation called what we call plucked nerves. We would go out into the straight community, put on a lot of makeup, tease boys, make them run after us. We would split up. We knew how to break up and reform. So in this arena, it became a frenetic choreography in which they couldn't catch the most militant people, because once you did something, you just danced through the crowd and came to another spot. The big problem was to keep the riot going. And it wasn't a conscious problem. It was a collective problem, and we knew how to do it. Taunting the police, never having rest. The noise was terrible. The cacophony was terrible. Some were watching. Sometimes you couldn't get away from the police. There'd be a bystander in your way. You could get caught. At one point, there was an opening, and there were the police. And no one knew what to do. So me and Bertie grabbed each other, moved forward, and did a kick line of "We Are the Village Girls." This definitely made the police charge. They charged from the front and from behind. I gave one last kick and fled. I got hit just a little bit on the back, and then again we were moving around. This lasted for quite some time. The cars were being attacked, but the passengers in those cars were, I did see it myself, were being taken to safety. It almost seemed organized, but it was organized because of all of our travails and such, and our need to escape the police, our need to do what we needed to do. But we did keep a riot going, and we kept it going for the night. When it was over, and the streets started emptying, and the exhaustion came in, and I thought, what did we do? And I sat down on a stoop and thinking we'll pay a dear price for this. But the street was beautiful. The broken glass just shone like diamonds, and the sun was going to rise soon. There were little pieces of cloth, so pretty, chartreuse and things, all the debris and detritus of a riot. It has its beauty, but I was nervous. And fortunately, I was wrong. The next day, the whole city heard about it, and there was much more support in the public population than I would have ever dreamed. And the good thing was that sometimes it's good to be wrong, because I was right 6 hours before. And that, to try to sum up, is the Stonewall Riot.
Thank you so much. Okay, delayed time. Okay, cool. Thank you so much for sharing that. And let's go ahead and hear from Philip, your story.
Well, first I want to say, are you hearing me with this?
Yes.
First I want to say I'm so moved. It's hard for me to go on. This brings it all back. You said it so eloquently and so beautifully. I think...
Thank you.
I think people who have never been involved in something like this don't really quite understand, and you can explain it to them and hopefully get them to finally see that it isn't just what we see on the headlines and the news, and it isn't just the cops here and the Queens here, and it's just this kind of interaction and we win one and they win one. It's about your life. It's about your well-being. And back in those days, if you were discovered to be gay, you could lose your job, your family, your community. Everything was at stake. And that's what I think it's hard for people today to understand. So when I talk about Stonewall, I'm not a Stonewall survivor. I don't ever say that I am. You know, there are so many pieces of the true cross when it comes to Stonewall survivors. I was there. I took up at the point of the kick line. I remember seeing the kick line and joining the crowd because I was just coming over to go to the bar. It was already too late. All of this had happened. And then I just kind of joined in the fray. And then the following days after that, I was trying to be one of those people to get more people into the square, more people to continue this thing. So I would go around from house to house in all the side streets of the village. My friends were doing the same thing. We were going up and down the streets saying, come out. It's time to come out and be seen. And the exciting part of it all was to stand there when finally the whole Sheridan Square was full of people. And for people who had hidden away for so many years, hidden their lives, never uttering the word, never honoring a relationship with another person of the same sex in public to someone who wasn't like you, that suddenly made it totally different. Here we all were. There were lots of us. I knew that I was gay at the age of 5. Now, I didn't know the word gay. I didn't know what it meant. All I knew was when I went to the swimming pool, I liked seeing the other guys. And, you know, and before they went outside, they didn't have their bathing suits on. So even at 5 years old, I thought, man, that's interesting. And as I got a little bit older, and I realized I was supposed to be interested in the girls that way, and I saw that I wasn't. And again, I said, well, that's interesting. I didn't know what it meant. I knew it was a dark secret that I couldn't share with anyone. Somehow I knew it was the one thing you could not say, ever. Too dangerous. It wasn't until I was about 15 or 16 that I found a book in the library, thank God for libraries, by Donald Webster Corey, called The Homosexual in America. And of course I looked it up under H. I had no idea about the word gay at that time. And I looked in this book, and it did talk about other people that sounded like they were people like me, but who were these people? At another time, in another place, there didn't seem to be anybody else around but me. And this is a hard thing for people today to understand. You've never heard the word, you've never heard us referred to in any way, except very, very rarely, such as when Liberace was accused of being a homosexual, denied it, took it to court, and won his case. You know, and nobody questioned it. He was just this nice man, you know? So this is, and if you were found out to be gay, you were considered crazy, you could be sent by your family to an asylum without any further reason than that you were doing these things with other people of the same sex. You were also a criminal. In Michigan, where I came from, it was a felony to even solicit in those days. And this gave a lot of work to the vice squad and a lot of kicks to them, too, I have to say. When I went to the University of Michigan from my hometown, I thought, okay, I'm now in the big city, it's going to be free, it's going to be great. And I found out that everything was undercover there also, very much so. There was a special little walk on the campus where at night, if you were walking there, you probably had a certain something in mind. So I went there to check it out. And there was a cop car in the darkness, and suddenly turned on his lights. Next thing I knew, the cop had me up against the car, was threatening me, was pounding me with his stick, was telling me if I didn't give the names of my friends, he would tell my family, he would tell the school, I would be finished. So of course I refused to do that. And I had already met a couple of other gay people by that time, and I knew that you didn't speak, because if you did, you were in big trouble. We had a kind of code amongst ourselves. You never gave anybody's name. You memorized phone numbers. You never wrote down another gay person's phone number in your book. In case you got in trouble, they would not be. So under those circumstances, I didn't talk. He kind of roughed me up a little bit. He said, you're going to be very sorry for this. And he let me go. Well, the next day I got called into the dean's office, and the dean told me that the University of Michigan did not want me to register for the following semester. They said, this is not a school that can put up with this kind of heinous behavior. That was the word that was used. So I thought for a minute, and I said, well, I guess I don't need a school which considers my behavior heinous, and I will find one somewhere else. So I agree with you. I don't need to register next term. And that's when I came to New York. And then when I got to New York, I thought, okay, now I'm in the big city. Now it's going to be free. Now it's going to be fine. And I found out, well, there's a crackdown going on in New York. This was 1964, and the World's Fair was coming on, and they wanted to clean up homeless people, gay people, and other undesirables so that people from other countries, where there were plenty of openly gay people all around, wouldn't know that we had any. And to this day, I don't quite understand the rationale of that, but I was arrested, I was charged, I was briefly in jail, and that whole experience led me to feel very defiant. My reaction after that was that I wanted to be a part of whatever was going to happen to make this change. So for a while, what we did was we would recognize the vice cops after a while, and they would come around to the bar, and we would just make a big circle around them and keep them identified. And we would point to them, this is the vice squad, this is the vice squad. Then they'd go out and try to go to another bar, and we would follow them. And when they got there, we would do the same thing. So we were kind of harassing them for a while. This was the extent of our activism until Stonewall. Stonewall, really, when I saw that, I thought, this is the most wonderful thing that's ever happened. This is finally that moment of freedom. And I still think of it as that. For all the problems we've had, we've never again had to do it alone. And I think that's the significance of Stonewall. You know, we've had lots of action since then. I can tell you about GLAAD and all the active things we did. I can tell you about ACT UP and all the other important things. We've been through the AIDS crisis together, all these things. But in a way, all of them have been in a much more of an atmosphere of freedom because of Stonewall. And I want to hand it to the survivors who actually initiated this stuff.
Well, thank you so much for sharing that story with us as well. What we're going to do first is turn it over to the audience for questions. If you guys don't have anything that leaps to mind, don't worry. Jason and I have been taking notes and have a nice list of questions that we want to ask. So we want to give you the chance to start off. We can do microphone running if you want. So, or we can start off the discussion with some of our questions and then break open the floor. Okay, Jason, do you have a question?
What do you think? My first question is, having this exhibition, there's been a huge, I was shocked by what a huge rush there's been of media interest in Stonewall this year, and it feels like it's much more than in previous years. And I'm curious as to what you think of how the media has been treating the Stonewall riots in this 40th anniversary. Thanks. I'll ask you. Yeah.
Well, I was very surprised. I mean, thank God there's a recession. I was busy for 60 days. You know, I'm a chef. So things have calmed down. I said, what am I going to do with my time? And this is what I did with my time. I mean, BBC, French television, all these new news things on the internet and everything. It's been tremendous, this kind of thing. And people have been receptive, and we've been able to explain a lot more than we could. Like, I just want to go back to something that he said, because this is a very brave thing he did to follow the Vice Squad. Mm-hmm. There was pre-Stonewall activity. We used to, as I was telling you before, there was a thing called plucking nerves. We weren't so completely passive. We would go out in any neighborhood we want to, dress the way we want to, and any, like we'd go to the museum and places we weren't supposed to be. And one day, I was with my friend Birdie, and I had an Isadora Duncan scarf. It was rayon, but it was 6 feet. A clutch bag, walking down 86th Street, and this plainclothes officer, well, he was taking those horses. It was a parade just before. And he went, oh, to me. And I said to him on 86th Street, I didn't know you could be like that and be in the police force. What a wonderful world. And I kept walking away from him. By the time that I got to the Met, it steps. All of a sudden, he grabbed the Isadora Duncan scarf and made a tourniquet out of it and strangled me till I was blue as a smurf and made me apologize to ever talk to a decent heterosexual like that again. These middle-class people and these museum-going people congratulated him on just doing his duty and making this city safer. They didn't realize we were still going to go in the museum. Nobody looked at a painting. They had wasted their day. They just looked at us, with me, with my mark on my neck. Birdie got hurt, too. There were all types of little things happening. One time, I was with six other queens. We were plucking nerves on 72nd Street in Central Park West, just in the park. We were playing hopscotch, something that drove everybody crazy. And there was a queen called, who stuttered, called Dead Frog Jerry. She thought she was very beautiful. She wasn't, but she thought so. In fact, how I met her on the steps of St. Joseph's Church, she was talking to someone who didn't listen to her, so she turned to me and she said, I'm a beauty now. Could you imagine what a few operations could do? And I said, I want to be her friend. She has such belief in medical science. I mean, she was amazing. So me, her, Squawky Jerry, my friend Birdie, we were all up there. We were playing hopscotch. We had a little radio. Dead Frog Jerry had a little celery-colored transistor. And someone had contemptuously given Dead Frog a balloon, which she accepted. And then all of a sudden, as we looked across the park, there were 6 to 8 really vicious guys that were intent on doing something about this. They got close to Dead Frog Jerry, and they were going to break her balloon. And I remember her saying, if you come and break that balloon, I will give you a gay knock. And that was an expression that we knew someone was really going to do something. I didn't think she'd do it. It was 3 o'clock in the afternoon in July. He broke the balloon. I looked down. Dead Frog hit him on the head with that radio. Pieces of that radio fell down amidst a few drops of blood. We had crossed the Rubicon, and it was red. The only thing to do now was flee. We fled. They were after us. Frog Jerry bravely, and I must say for her, retreated as we were routed and was screaming at us, come back here, you bitches, and fight like queens. I said, no. Squawking Jerry kneeled in front of a doorman and said, please, mister, please, just take me and I'll never be bad again. I said, this is not going to work. And the trouble was that we were all trying to get to this queen's house. Otherwise, we would have split up. We would have lost these boys very easily. Because we stayed as a group, they were following us as a group. But we did get away. Dead Frog did survive. We got into a building up to the queen's house and stayed on the floor with no lights on for hours, fearing that these boys. So we were, like I said, fighting back, you know, to follow the police and to indicate to other people that, you know, this was the vice squad. Or we would try to tell each other what the vice squad would usually wear. You know, and this was an evil time because you must say the vice squad were usually very well endowed men. So somebody was picking them in a way that was really awful. And there was that rule that you had to have 3 articles of male clothing, and it did not include socks, so they could arrest you because it could destroy any drag outfit. So, you know, it was like they were harassing us every which way you can. I'll just tell you one simple more example. I went to a costume party. I went as Oscar Wilde, and I came, but I knew enough to carry my receipts in my pocket for those clothes. I stayed on the train and wound up in East New York, and there was a gang of boys there looking at me, and the policeman detained me long enough that I couldn't get the subway so that they could get at me. And he hassled me, and I brought out my receipts, and we went one-on-one, and then he left me alone. And those boys didn't attack me because I had stood up to the police. So these were very, very, very difficult times, these times he's talking about. And he did remind me of all these things, but we did fight back in many ways.
I'd like to hear from you where you think the fight back went. Because right now, you know, the Bloomberg Police Department has been falsely arresting gay men for prostitution for going on 2.5 years before one of them came forward and said, I was really mistreated here. I was, you know, this was totally false arrest. Now it's being investigated, but only one of them has been cleared. Where the hell is the fight back spirit for people now?
May I address that? Because that's something that's been on my mind a lot. Where has it gone? And I think partly it's a result of our successes. I think a lot of people have gotten to the point where they think, well, things are getting better, and if there's still a little problem, it's okay. It's on the road. We're getting there. I think there's a lot of that kind of complacency in the community. Secondly, I think, especially in the last 8 years, protest has been attacked so viciously and so thoroughly that people are afraid. You know, I know young people who would love to be out in the street doing protests, but they see on TV, and again, let me include the media in that, that are portraying all this protest as something which is illegal or is made to seem illegal, which is shown to be illegal and is treated that way. But all those people were arrested, you know, at the Republican convention. I couldn't believe it. They were all arrested, not just a few like we used to get. So I think people are afraid. Also, I think there's a sense that the tide is turning, and some of that is true. And I think we need to stay with it. We need to not be complacent, because now when we get Obama and we think, okay, here we are again, here I am in the city again, everything's going to be fine, right? Obama's in. And he's hopefully got his heart in the right place, but what's been happening? Not much. You know, very little. Little, too little at the last minute that makes it look like making up for something. I can understand why so many of the gay donors have been backing out of the funding for the party, because this was our hope. We've got to send a message. And I agree with that, because we have to send a message. You can't ever just say, okay, we'll wait. We know you've got other things on your plate. We'll wait. When is that going to happen? You know, I'm going on 68. I waited long enough. And I would like to see this happen in my lifetime, and I think it can. But to answer your question about the reason that it seems to change around and people now interested, part of that, I think, is the straight community has always been interested in us for our money, right from the beginning. And I can remember, too, that they were interested in us for the prestige when it was in to be gay for a while in the 70s. You know, if you were seen at Studio 54 with somebody who was gay, well, that was a feather in your bonnet. So I think it's self-interest. It takes many forms. But I think if they have something to gain, they'll be for us. If they feel they have something to gain being against us, they'll be against us. Also, I think people like to be seen as being on the right side of things. And when the tide does turn, I think you'll find a lot of people who were undecided will side with us because, okay, now it's okay, so I can be on that side. I've known well-meaning people who've been against us because it's the thing to do, because they're told that in their church or they're hearing that in the media or whatever. And I think a lot of very good people who would be for us if they really felt that it was okay to be, will be once the tide has turned. But we're all responsible for that. And I really believe that by coming out, you do the one thing that means more than anything else, and always has. You know, that's a political act, it's a personal act. It takes some bravery, but it means an awful lot. When even Dick Cheney can get on TV and change his mind, whatever you want to say about that family, that says something. It's very powerful.
My next question, if I could ask, is what do you think is the... Curating the exhibition, I was almost terrified to even go near Stonewall in a certain way because it seems like there's something that so many people have so many different debates about what happened, who was there, who wasn't there. What do you think is, for you, the thing that you think people get wrong, is the biggest misconception about the riots in that time period? If I could ask, actually, Philip first and then you, Mark.
I think it's like George Washington, you know. It's nice to hear about chopping down the apple tree and all that stuff. The truth of it is so much more personal and gets lost because historians tend to talk about what happened. They don't tend to talk about the people. I think the things that reveal most what it was about are things like the first film about Harvey Milk, The Times of Harvey Milk, where they interviewed the people who were there and who knew him. That kind of testimony, that kind of personal thing, gives you more of a feeling for what happened. The whole idea of Stonewall has become a symbol. And it's appropriately so. I think it's great. You know, it's like Washington on the dollar bill. It's there. It's always going to be there. It's an important symbol for us.
And you, Martin, what is your biggest misconception?
The biggest problem that occurred and lasted for a very long time, until David Carter, I think, was that, for instance, Lota Lenya, at Three Penny Opera, she said she met 10,000 people who had been to the opening, but it only sat 800. To differentiate who was really there and who wasn't there was a very difficult problem to do, because anybody could say they were there and then make up what they want. I think David Carter has legitimatized some of the voices and faces of Stonewall. Now you can get much more of the truth, at least from some, but again, it's all like Rashomon. I mean, each person saw what they saw. But nonetheless, we still now, at least now, we have a basis of, you can believe the person that you're listening to, as opposed to, is this a fantasy? And that was a problem always, the idea of who was there. And the other problems, but it all stems from that. The other problem was how much interest it would continue into the future. And you see, it really did become, even like from the first parade, you know, we went up 6th Avenue and we got a little piece of 6th Avenue. I was so disappointed. And it started out as a question mark. There weren't many of us. But when we got up to Central Park, it ended in an exclamation point. There were so many of us. It was a success. And it started out with our hearts down here and then our hearts up here. It was great. And but I do think, basically, now that we found out who's there and who isn't there, I think that is a plus.
Yeah, I just want to add, yes, David Carter got to a lot more truth in that book, I think, than previous ones. But the other thing is, you remember on that march up the avenue, how each precinct would send out their troops on horses and try to block us off. And then we just locked arms. And like you said, the heart was started down here somewhere, and it was like being together and doing that together, I think, was, it just brought us up. And by the time we got to the park and we saw all these people, it was like just amazing.
Yeah. And little by little, because somebody would peer out a window on 6th Avenue and wave. And that wave was so heartfelt because the windows weren't full. But for the ones that were watching us, you could feel the cheer in their heart or the interest. Like this Japanese man came up to me and said, "They would never allow this in my country." I said, "They don't allow it here." I said, "Look around." You know, this was like completely new territory for us. So, I mean, it was a great deal of support. I mean, when I got home, well, from Stonewall itself, my father did congratulate me. My father was a very rough man. He used to train boxers and fighting dogs. And imagine, he had such a femme son. I mean, from this big. I mean, and so he was very, very proud of me. And he goes, "What took you so long?" And there were other people in the neighborhood, you know, saying that you were always oppressed. I think a lot of people understood. But there was another value to homosexuality in the city before 1969, and it was entertainment value. Because when I was a little kid, my cousin would get me in the car and say, "Well, they say, let's take little Marty to see the faggots." And he would take me to all the gay places. I knew where to go by 11. "And let's take little Marty to see the prostitutes." And then I saw these fantastically beautiful, sophisticated women with Billie Holiday flowers in their hair. Just, I couldn't wait to grow up. But I didn't know what I was going to grow into. And the disappointment of what was happening just before Stonewall made Stonewall happen in this way. Our dreams were always crushed. It was a Peace Corps, but I couldn't go in it. Why? Because you're gay. And I always wanted to be a history teacher, but you couldn't be an open history teacher. So many dreams, even if they were just fantasies that would keep you going at any job, were closed. And in this, and to say one thing, that in this library, when I used to come here in 1962 on a rainy day to try to find out a little bit about myself around the abnormal psychology books and things like that, you should see the lonesome characters that I certainly didn't want to be, trying to find out about themselves so desperately in this damp, damp atmosphere. It made me very, very ill. And I said, I'm never going to, I'd rather die than live like this. Die. And I didn't live like that. When I realized if I put bee-stung lips on, I could get so much attention and make them so upset. Of course, that's what made me a drag queen. I only gave it up when I found a husband or a lover. So no, we knew about Tennessee Williams. We knew about William Inge. We knew about Truman Capote. We had a gay history, but we had to piece it together. And we had this thing what a younger man would do for, an older man would do for a younger man. My first lover was 35. I was 16. I left school because they were going to have showers in school, and I didn't want anybody to find out what was going to happen, what would happen to me. I didn't know. And he made me read the 100 great books from this library. He got the list. And I could not come see him if I hadn't completed a certain amount of those books. He would say, "No, go home. You'll see me when you finish that book." So we were able to educate ourselves and form a history. There were so many great gay people working in all these fields. And underground, the grapevine, we knew. And we knew. And we could piece a history together and even borrow people from straights, you know, like Mae West or Laurel and Hardy. Why were they in bed? Because when you're oppressed, you think a lot. Like, this is sort of gay to me. Or Looney Tunes, where Bugs Bunny could completely go in drag. These were such hopeful things, done in such vivid color and with such panache, that I pieced together my history. And I think a lot of us did that. And New York, don't forget, this was the New York of the 60s. There was not one aspect or field in New York that didn't have a great person in it, including jockeys out in Belmont. These were the days of Shoemaker, Maria Callas, and everything was filled with someone great. And a lot of them we knew was gay. You know, not Shoemaker. But, you know, this was, so there was a lot going on. I mean, Capote admitted he was gay. It was obvious that Williams and Inge were gay. So we knew something. Nothing starts from nothing. And I think that young people today really do have to know more of their history. And if the burden of piecing that together, that history is on them, they must. Because this world is never finished. And the history books are never closed. It's up to us. Thank you.
But it's fascinating. And I'd love to hear it again and again and again. And I think when I saw that, I said, is the history being told? Mm. You know, is it?
Well, it is our response.
It's like the irony is that it just this parallel of what happened then, and I was came to New York 10 years later, maybe, is what's going on in Iran right now. I think, you know, it's the same. When you saw the picture on yesterday's Times on the Weekend Review, when it was a young kid, it could have been, you know, it could have been 1969.
Yeah. Well, and of course, people are in different places in different parts of the world now.
Yeah.
And there are lots of gay people around the world that are not in the position that we are. And so that's another reason for us to keep this going, because we're, in a way, kind of the forefront of what's hopefully a worldwide movement, ultimately. But that's a lot of work to be done. And when we do have to do it, and telling it is part of doing it, I think. And for each person to tell their own story, to their own family, to their own, you know, business associates and whoever they deal with, is a big part of telling that story.
Linux, or could I ask a question, then we'll ask Manny? Looking at this year, what seems, 1969, 1970, sorry, what seemed most compelling to me is not just the Stonewall riots, but also that people carried that energy forward into their lives and into society as a whole. That, I mean, within weeks of the riots, that there were activists trying to channel that energy into concrete activism. I'm interested in what was your involvement in that kind of activism that followed, and also how did this transform your life, these events?
Okay. Well, one of the first things that happened was there were incidents. Friends of mine would get attacked, for example, on the street. So I lived in the West Village right near the bar. So in the days and weeks after Stonewall, there were lots more incidents. The cops were not immediately cowed, unfortunately. And every time there was an incident, somebody would get beat up or something. Then the cops would side with the attackers. And they would even laugh at you. They'd think it was very funny, this whole thing. And so we formed a brigade. We formed a couple of brigades, which were kind of precursors to something that was later formed called the Pink Panthers, where we'd take matters into our own hands. We'd get a bunch of us together, and with the strength of numbers, we would patrol some of the streets in the area to make sure that they were safe. We also set up a phone tree, and if anything happened, we would immediately get the phone tree going and get people involved, calling the precincts, calling an ambulance, or whatever needed to happen. Later on, I joined GLAAD, and GLAAD was a wonderful group. We had a phone tree. In the beginning, it was a very human activity. It was nothing about internets or anything in those days. It was, you got on the phone, you called. If you were the trunk, you called your branches, the branches called the twigs called the leaves, and by the time you were done with it, you had 1,000 people calling their congressman or calling the newspaper. What was it? Why was this article printed? Or calling the movie theater. Why did you play this homophobic movie? And we did what we called zaps, which was left over, I think, from the GAA, where we would actually go to the offices. For example, the Post had a columnist named Ray Kerrison,
who wrote
almost daily about how horrible we were and how we were going to be the death of America. And so finally we organized a zap down at their offices where we made a pile of Post newspapers and set them on fire for that. It did carry on. And I think it carried on again in the era of AIDS with ACT UP. And I remember the first ACT UP demonstration at City Hall where there were like three of us, I think. But that feeling was there again, like this is, again, a grassroots kind of thing. It's us. We have to do this. Nobody else is going to do this. We have to do it. Even when the ambulances were not picking up people when they died, I mean, we really were on top of those things too, and we had an organization of people who had cars who were willing to drive people to the hospital if the ambulance wouldn't pick them up. So yeah, it's all been carried forward. And I think now with the younger generation, you're going to see a lot more of that in the online communities. And it may be different. To me, it feels a little strange because it's not as directly personal. And yet, I know that young folks do feel this community. And I think that's going to be very helpful because you can get lots of people very quickly in online communities.
How did it change your life, and how did that carry forward into your life?
Most of us had individual pride before that night, but when that night was over, we had a pride of consensus, and that was very different. We looked at each other very different. We had fought together in a way that made us now closer to each other, and I think our ability to organize would serve us very well in the tragic decade of the 80s. And had that epidemic come earlier, you could imagine how bad it would have been. No, we were open now to finding the ways and the things that we had to do in order to protect ourselves. They were all little things like this phone bank or what it was to call each other. I remember all those things. We were helping each other little by little, but all the time, and again as years went on. So it changed everything. And also, I opened a bistro in the East Village in 1986. And I could not have had that bistro the way which I wanted it before 1969. It was completely integrated, gay, straight. It was just the kind of place I wanted to own. I would have never had that without Stonewall. And it was so beautiful when people would get engaged there and gay people would join the straight people in the celebrations of these. It was just nice. It was nice to be integrated. It was nice to respect each other. It was nice just not to have to hate because someone hates you, you know. It was different.
Randy, you had a question?
Yeah. This is sort of more of an activism question. You're talking about plucking nerves. And also, you mentioned the GAA zaps. There was a lot of, even with the hippies at the Democratic Convention when they were having their heads caved in 68 chanting, the whole world is watching. It seems to me there used to be a street theater to political activism. And I'm searching my mind that I can't think of anything like that that's going on today, except maybe the drag march the other night or something. But
Church Ladies for Choice.
Not, but really, there's something different. Like there was the whole idea of I guess you would say political theater seems to me to have either faded or been lost or been taken over by a bunch of even glad. I mean, yeah, I'm glad we have these highly paid, effective bureaucrats in Washington. And when I was a college activist, they denounced me, and I said, well, the gay movement has a bunch of highly paid, mealy-mouthed bureaucrats in Washington. Lobbyists, that's a good thing. Does anybody in our society have a bunch of highly paid bureaucrats in Washington representing their interests? It's the way society works. But it seems to me that our whole society, beyond the gay movement as well, but the whole society, you know, organized labor makes a statement, the gay national task force makes a statement, the human rights care, GLAD makes a statement. There isn't anyone plucking anybody's nerves. I love that term, by the way. And what you're saying about the way when you pluck the nerves, you create a dynamic and a theater and excitement. And I don't see anywhere anymore in any movement, unless there's something I don't know about. Maybe there's something going on that I've missed. Do you think that's true?
It's very true. But the 60s were the 60s. You know, the 60s was a great secular awakening in which all these things played out. Each of us helped the group that we were in or the group we were sorry for instead of at first helping ourselves because we were gay. I mean, I would help the NAACP volunteer. I would volunteer for feminist groups for my sister. Never occurred to me that I could help myself. And I didn't respect hippies because they didn't really like us because they dropped out and we were just out. So they had no respect for us. And we had a lot, and demographics had something to do with it. We had a lot more working class people then. And all those queens that fought, the militant ones, were all working class queens that were used to a fight and had nothing to lose. Today, if you're arrested or something happens and with enormous rents, I feel sorry for people, you know. They couldn't take the time in jail and things like that. Things have changed so much. People have but we're in the danger of depending upon organizations. That's the problem. And that's, I think, what you really mean. And I think that maybe the time will come. Maybe we'll get another shock or whatever. But I think that, you know, now it's not just, it's all about human rights. We've really fought for human rights. It's not just the problems we face in this country, but it's a worldwide situation for universal gay rights equaling human gay rights as part of one thing. Maybe if they show some footage of what happens to gays in Iran, Iraq, West Africa, maybe there will be demonstrations. Because there's certainly enough demonstrations in California over Proposition, you know, A and everything. So, no, they're there, but not enough anger's there. And we don't really want the anger until it's needed and it's useful.
And again, that's a personal thing. And I think when you're in the street with somebody and you're encouraging each other and that anger is coming out, and it's hard for that to happen in a boardroom, or it's hard for that to happen in the halls of Congress at a hearing or something, it's harder. The less personal it is, the harder it is to experience the emotional part of it. And I agree with you. I think it's sort of been taken over by the larger groups. And hopefully we can get back to some of the more personal stuff. Partly, though, it depends on how much people are intimidated. And that depends on the government and the media and, you know, how much protest is allowed in this country. It's a little scary sometimes. But I agree with you. It is necessary. And if we're pushed far enough, it probably will happen. Because people need to be pushed quite far. In 69, we had been pushed, as he said, for years. We had been fighting back in little ways. But we were finally pushed just too far. And I think that could happen again. I hope it could happen again, that we would respond personally.
So we're just watching our time. Do we have a last question from the audience? If not, I know Jason has at least one more that he'd like to ask.
Martin, where did the We Are the Village Girls parody come from? I've heard lots of different versions of the words of that parody, and it's not the most pressing question, but it was a question.
It's a campy question. Yeah. My friend Birdie was the one who loved it most, and she taught it to me on Greenwich Avenue, and we would just do it to do it. We never thought it would come in handy. The way Birdie did it was wonderful. Birdie was so theatrical. And the way she did it, she just wanted to do it too. You know, it was like that. It was just so cool, so campy, and let's do it too. And that's where it originates from. I mean, she taught me the words. And when she let her arm out, I linked into it. We just knew what we were doing. But, I mean, I thought that was a very campy song. And we would just do it.
So we've focused a lot of our discussion on the future, both in the past. And so just real quick, the 60s and 70s had Stonewall, then the 80s had AIDS, and the 90s had DOMA and Don't Ask, Don't Tell. What are the keystone issues as we look forward for the gay rights movement?
Well, for me...
To both.
Okay. Well, for me personally, it's I'm starting to look outside the borders of the United States and seeing how terrible these conditions are in the Islamic world and in many other places in that. And I'm giving more and more of my thoughts to that and to those people because they're starting from where we started or less. I mean, this kind of governments are truly repressive. I mean, there's no assemblies or anything to get around. They can just do what they want. I think, you know, if we learn our history, young people, and... if we do what we can, some can do what we can for here, others will do outside our borders. But together, I think we're still doing a very good job. But there's so much to do. And it's only been 40 years, you know, straight people had how many, you know? So I think it's going rather well. I mean, I don't know. I think it's 6 states or 5 states now that have the marriage equality law. Whatever it is, we couldn't possibly believe that. We said somebody was our husband because we lived with them 6 months, you know. And now you really can have one. That was just beyond our dreams.
I agree that the international situation is going to be part of it, but also just amongst ourselves. The question that came up for me when I saw the crowd again at Stonewall was, are we going to be able to stay together? And I know over the years we've had a lot of divisions with the men and the women, with the old and the young, with the black and the white, and the other communities being separate or not feeling included. There's been a lot of prejudice in our own ranks. I think we have to acknowledge that and try to overcome that, because we're about difference. Think about it, LGBT. Each of those things, if you're one of those things or more, you're different by definition. So we're not fighting to be just like you. We're fighting to be us. And that's the fight. And that means all of us. That's why it's appropriate that it's all of us together, LGBT. So I think we have work to do in that area too, to make sure that we are together in this.
Thank you. Awesome answer. Anything else from you, Jason?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, I'm done.
So, any more questions?